This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Jeremy Knoll, a project manager and architect for BNIM, joins host Craig Lubow to talk about green building and social equity. He is a national and local leader for both the U.S. Green Building Council and Historic Green. Jeremy will talk about designing green buildings, LEED certification, and economical efficiency for residential homes as well. But first, I'm Natural E with your headline news. Reuters.com reports, a stricken Iranian tanker that sank in the East China Sea on Sunday in the worst oil ship disaster in decades has produced a large oil slick, Chinese media and Japanese authorities said on Monday, as worries grew over damage to the marine ecosystem. The Sanchi's crew of 30 Iranians and two Bangladeshis are all believed to have perished in the incident, which marks the biggest tanker spill since 1991 when 260,000 tons of oil leaked off the Angolan coast. The East China Sea is known for its rich, although already polluted, marine ecosystem that includes whales, porpoises, and seabirds, said Rick Steiner, a U.S. marine scientist with experience of oil spills. The blazing vessel, which had been carrying 136 tons, almost 1 million barrels, 136,000 tons, excuse me, almost 1 million barrels of condensate, an ultralight, highly flammable crude oil, sank on Sunday after several explosions weakened the hull. Experts worry the ship sinking is potentially more damaging to the marine ecosystem than letting the condensate oil burn off. The sinking will likely expel the remaining condensate in the tanker's bunker fuel or the heavy fuel oil that powers a ship's engines, contaminating the surrounding waters. Bunker fuel is the dirtiest kind of oil, extremely toxic when spilled, though less explosive. Condensate is poisonous to marine organisms. EcoWatch.com reports, Thursday, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, issued a decision which spells bad news for the proposed Constitution Pipeline, a 124-mile natural gas pipeline slated to run through New York State and Pennsylvania. Constitution Pipeline went to FERC and asked them to invalidate the New York Department of Environmental Conservation's denial for a necessary Clean Water Act permit for the project. Thursday, FERC rejected that request. In its decision on Thursday, FERC maintained the state's decision and rejected Constitution's attempt to shorten the time states have to consider natural gas pipeline applications for Clean Water Act permits. Constitution will be able to appeal FERC's decision or to go back to New York State and try to reapply with a different application. And finally, EcoWatch.com reports, all species evolve over time to have distinct preferences for survival. But with rapidly changing synthetic chemicals, sometimes animals don't have a chance to develop a beneficial aversion to something harmful. New research from the University of Illinois indicates that honeybees, which are dying en masse, may actually prefer the taste of flowers laced with pesticides that are likely harmful. The study tested honeybee consumption of different sugar syrups, some plain and some with different concentrations of common pesticides. They found that while the bees didn't care for syrup with extremely high concentrations of pesticides at low levels, the bees flocked to those pesticides. Among the pesticides tested were the ever-controversial glyphosate, the most common pesticide in the U.S., which previous studies have also shown to be attractive to honeybees.
Hey, thank you for joining us. This is Craig Lubow, and my guest today is Jeremy Knoll. He is a project manager at BNIM architecture firm. He has a deep passion for green building and social equity in three projects such as LEED Platinum Bancroft School Apartments in historic Mannheim Park, the Crosswords Charter Schools, and transformation of the Lyric into a full-service YMCA downtown. Jeremy has been dedicated to creating in repurposing beautiful and accessible spaces in Kansas City with an emphasis on inclusion and sustainability. He also serves as a board member of Reengage and is the chair of the U.S. Green Building Council's Central Plains Community. Welcome, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks.
let's start with a couple of those things you do outside your architecture firm, the U.S. Green Building Council and the Re-Engage. What are those two agencies?
Sure. So the U.S. Green Building Council was really formed in 1993 and came together as a cross-industry way of really defining what green buildings are and what that means, and created a way to measure all green buildings, or really all buildings, against each other through the point-based system that I'm sure we'll be talking about here in a little bit. And then Re-Engage is an organization that was founded in 2013, which has the sole purpose of training and certifying un- and underemployed men in Kansas City to work on construction projects and to be placed in permanent jobs with those agencies that they join.
Okay. And you have several projects you've worked on as an architect there, and we'll get we'll start talking about the commercial building.
Sure.
And then we'll talk a little bit about residential as well. And also, I do want to give out our phone number. We will take phone calls from listeners if you have any questions. And the number is 816-931-5534. It's 816-931-5534. What are some of the major projects you've worked on recently?
So a few projects to mention just that I worked on recently that I think people in Kansas City might have some awareness of would be the Kansas City Zoo's polar bear exhibit. It was one that I worked on early in my career. As you mentioned, the Bancroft School Apartments, which is a 50 affordable units that are certified LEED Platinum over in Manheim Park, over near 43rd and Tracy. And then other projects include things like the Johnson County Crime Lab, and I'm also working on the Crossroads Charter Schools and the YMCA downtown, and a number of other projects like that.
All right. And these are all, through your work, going to be buildings and repurposed buildings that are sustainable. And are they all going to be LEED certified? Or
yeah, so not every building is going that I mentioned is going to be or is LEED certified. LEED really makes the most sense for new construction and major renovations. When we do projects that are affecting just a part of a building, it's a little bit more difficult to apply that certification to it. And just to back up, and I want to make sure that I'm using language that is accessible here. So LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. It's a point-based rating system provided by the U.S. Green Building Council, which is a national nonprofit, and it uses categories to ensure a holistic approach rather than a single focus. So, for example, instead of having projects that only focus on water efficiency or only focus on energy efficiency, by pursuing LEED certification, you're really saying that we're doing all of these things. We're doing water, energy, transportation, sites. We're thinking about materials, and we're also looking at the indoor environmental quality and the health of the occupants.
And just in case somebody missed that, tell us what the LEED initials are.
Again. So again, it's Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design is what LEED stands for, LEED. Okay. And more than anything else, as a person practicing architecture in Kansas City and in the U.S., what it has done for the way that we talk about sustainability is it's provided a common language within the design and development industry where we're working within a very similar set of priorities. We're using the same words to describe the same types of actions that we need to take on a construction site, which surprisingly is not as common as you think it would be.
And there's different levels of LEED certification. I know there's platinum, gold, and
yeah. So it really starts at certified, which in rough terms is about 50% of the total available points, and that ratchets all the way up to platinum. So it goes certified, then silver, gold, and platinum is the highest you can get under the LEED rating system. There are other rating systems out there as well, such as the Living Building Challenge, which really focuses on projects that are pursuing net zero energy and water and waste, which means that all told, those projects don't pollute and are not using resources in total over the course of a year. And then there's also WELL certification, which is focused more on, which is W-E-L-L, which is focused on really human health and occupancy of buildings. And increasingly, we really use these rating systems in tandem with each other, referencing one or the other as we go about designing our buildings, whether they're commercial or residential.
And so with most of the LEED certified, whether it's the certified gold or platinum, with majority of those also be getting certified under one of those other categories?
Not necessarily. Doing multiple certifications is still pretty uncommon, but more than certifying under multiple, we often reference the other guides as a way to help refine the strategies that we're using on our particular project. So, for example, if I'm working on a high school, I might pursue all of the things that I would do for a normal LEED certified building, but I might pull from some of the credits that are available to me in the WELL certification system, because I know that they're going to focus more than LEED is able to, since LEED is more holistic. The WELL system is going to focus more on the occupant health, ability to focus in a space, the access to natural light, things like that, that will affect things, everything from test scores to how many sick days kids will take, to the teacher's sense of well-being in the space that they're in.
All right. And for, let's start with the LEED, the different certifications there. What has to be put into a construction project or into the building to make it LEED certified? What are the sustainability elements that are looked at to classify it that way?
Sure. So as I mentioned, LEED certification breaks the way that we talk about and think about sustainability into categories, which include transportation, which is sort of how do you get to the site, and once you're there, do you park, are you taking a bus, are you riding your bike? Thinking about site, which is another category, which is focused on what is happening around the building. Is it surrounded by asphalt? Is it pervious paving? Is it parkland around it? What do you have access to? Water efficiency is next on the list, and that I think is sort of obviously focusing on how efficient are the fixtures within the building, but then it's also about what's happening with things like stormwater. What happens to the raindrops that fall on the building? Are you capturing them for reuse or sending them onto storm sewer? Energy efficiency, I think, is what most people think of when you start talking about green building. That's obviously going to be part of LEED certification, and really focusing on energy efficiency first and then renewables later, because you want to get the size of the building, or really sort of what we call the footprint of the building, correct before you start to offset that with any kind of renewable energy. Materials is the next category, and that focuses on everything from the amount of recycled content that's going into the building materials that are being specified and put into place, to does the building have a permanent recycling program, and what's happening with the construction waste at the end of the project. And then finally is environmental quality, which gets into everything from occupant access to natural daylight, the indoor air quality, how well filtered is the air as it moves through the space, what are the characteristics of the materials that we're installing in there? Are they off-gassing various chemicals that are known to be carcinogenic, or are we specifying materials that naturally don't do that? I think you'd be surprised at how many materials are in sort of our common circulation that do off-gas pretty terrible compounds. And it takes some careful thought and work to make sure that we're using more and more products that don't do that, and putting pressure on some of our materials manufacturers to offer more products to both us and to consumers to be able to have options in that front.
You mentioned this, one of the latter things, the materials that may be emitting carcinogenic I guess that would be mostly like fumes and stuff.
Yeah, it's sort of the new car smell, which the new car smell is actually poison.
So the question I've got about that is when I buy stuff at Lowe's or other building material places, an awful lot of what I pick up and look at has a warning. It doesn't say it's carcinogenic. It says that California has determined that it's carcinogenic.
So those materials, those materials are part of what's known as in our industry as the red list, and the red list is materials like chlorides and other. And I don't think I could rattle some of the scientific names off my head here, but of all the chemistry that goes into it. But I will say that a number of the large sort of home material providers are creating specific programs that are about removing those materials. And it's not out of everything, but if you look at Lowe's or Home Depot or Ace or anywhere, you'll start to see more products that specifically call out that they are not using things like added urea for formaldehyde in insulation, which has only recently really kind of been removed from most products in that industry. But there is more and more access to them, and the more people like us ask for those products at when we go to pick up a 2x4 or whatever we need for our home DIY project, the more that those places will offer those over time.
And are those products that are on that list, are they banned in California?
They are, yes and no. There are some products that you really are not supposed to use on projects in California, but it's more than anything, it's that you have to provide a visible warning, similar to buying a pack of cigarettes and having the big warning on the side of the pack. There is the idea that if you're using those materials, that you'll have to have some kind of warning that you're entering a space or entering a building where those materials are present.
And so in Kansas City or any other city outside of California,
sure,
if a builder uses materials that contain those chemicals, is there a way that employees that are going to be working in those buildings would be able to find out or know that there were products with those chemicals used?
Use of the chemicals that we're talking about has really been standard practice for a long time, and a lot of those materials have been added at different times for various reasons. We probably don't have time to go all the way through here today, but things like flame retardants being added to even home products like sofas have created a real and lasting health issue in our culture. Really, in my mind, the best way to know that a building has at least made an attempt to remove those types of materials is a certification, is having somebody prove that they've looked at every material and that they've made an effort to find the products that don't contain those or that contain substantially lower levels of those chemicals of concern.
And so the LEED certification, some of those others would look at, and if they have those, if they're using those materials, they would not be able to get LEED certified?
Well, it depends. It depends. That is mostly correct, is that the primary red list materials under the current version of LEED certification are really not allowed. And what we're seeing more than just not allowing all of those chemicals is that we have to report that they're there, that we are putting more pressure on our manufacturers to disclose what chemicals are going into both their manufacturing process, but then also what are being off-gassed out of the final products.
Okay. And for those just joining us, we'll get to take a break in a second. When we come back, we are taking phone calls, so please give us a call if you have a question, 816-931-5534. We'll go to a break now.
As a friendly reminder from your community radio station, an unattended running car can be a temptation to a would-be thief. No one likes to get into a cold car, but it's best to make sure your car will be there to get into. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
For 30 years, KKFI has been supported by listeners just like you. Thank you for being there for us so we can be there for you. To help sustain independent community radio, go to kkfi.org and click donate.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Martin Luther King Jr. envisioned a world where everyone lived in harmony. He and others called it a beloved community.
It is a community where we have racial justice, where we don't have discrimination, and where we're living together as brothers and sisters, sitting at common tables together and enjoying the bounty that this earth has to offer without divisions.
Jacqueline Patterson of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program says to achieve King's vision, we must address climate change.
We see climate change as a civil rights issue.
She says minority and low-income populations are disproportionately affected by global warming. For example, it's low-income residents who struggle most with pollution, food insecurity, and the lack of resources to rebuild after a disaster. But she says the vision of a beloved community can give people a goal to work towards. If they imagine the future they want and identify the obstacles, they can then chart a pathway forward.
Then people would be able to really start to think in terms of solutions.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Okay, welcome back. For those just joining us, you are listening to Eco Radio, and my guest today is Jeremy Knoll, and he is an architect project manager at BNIM, and we talk about energy efficiency in building and sustainability in construction of commercial and somewhat with residential buildings. And we are taking calls, so if you want to have any questions, our number again is 816-931-5534. One of the things that you had mentioned when we talked about some of the carcinogenic chemicals was the flame retardants that you mentioned. So are there alternatives that have been developed that have been proven safe? Because in the past, 10, 15, 20 years ago, seemed like the choice was you either take the risk with the cancer or you have furniture that's flammable. Going to burn down your house.
to back out the reason that we have flame retardants in a lot of our materials, it really was the result of a sort of a long and drawn out lawsuit with the cigarette industries about people falling asleep in bed and then lighting their mattress on fire, essentially, from that. And the cigarettes say, no, we shouldn't have to make cigarettes burn out, but we should, stuff some chemicals into whatever the areas are that are of concern. So, yes, there are definitely alternatives to pumping flame retardants into the materials that we're putting into our buildings. And among several of those would be things like using less foam plastics in the types of insulation that we're using, and less plastic in general in our buildings, because when those plastics catch on fire, even with flame retardants, they tend to off-gas some of the worst chemicals that man has ever created into the smoke that people getting out of the building are breathing in, and our first responders are exposed to coming in to respond to an emergency. But there are things like in insulation, for example, where we can use a material that is made out of essentially it's called rock wool rather than one of those foam plastics. So as long as you can seal up the outside of the building so you're not leaking air out, either by using a house wrap or there's quite a few products available for that part of it. But instead of using a foam plastic to fill the cavity of the wall, you can use rock wool instead, and that is a passively, just naturally fire retardant material. It's like trying to light a rock on fire.
And we did just get a phone call. The caller wanted me to ask you your thoughts on insulated concrete forms.
Sure. So as long as thermal bridging is being appropriately dealt with in an insulated concrete form, then it is a fine solution. If it is a form where you are using essentially a styrofoam block on the outside and then pouring concrete into it, I personally find that problematic, again, from that flame retardant issue, because a lot of the forms actually have flame retardant in them. So if they catch on fire at any point in the life of that building, it runs the risk of off-gassing those materials. Now, there are certainly ways you can deal with that, like putting a layer of gyprock on the inside of that to cover up that foam plastic and protect it a little bit better from any source of flame. But it'd be better to just not have it there in the first place. So I am seeing things like insulated precast concrete, where we sandwich a piece of insulation in between essentially two pieces of concrete and then tip that into place for building out an interior space in the middle of it. And that tends to deal with thermal bridging pretty well, as long as you get the transitions to roof and the ground correct. Hope that answers the question.
Okay. And if anybody else has any questions, feel free to give us a call. It's 816-931-5534. Some of the other projects you've had, what are some of the key things that make a building, that are the biggest focus to make a building sustainable?
Sure. So I think energy efficiency is definitely a place that we try to start, is really looking at how much energy is the building going to use over the lifetime of its use and really day to day. So getting things, focusing on things like insulation first. So let's make the building not only face itself on the site correctly, so that we're capturing sun when it makes sense for us to do that, and able to control everything from that standpoint. But it's also then looking at how can we decrease the size of our mechanical systems by making the outside of the building more efficient. And then once we've got through that, then we start to talk about some of the renewables that we might bring in. Other areas that we tend to focus on, or that I feel like maybe a decade ago were hard to talk about with clients that are now much more standard in what we design and build, would be things like LED lights, that we can lower the electrical usage of a building substantially by switching from something like a T12 style light bulb down to an LED fixture, and try to do that throughout. There's also things that we do really increasingly, such as using low flow faucets and toilets to reduce the use of water in our buildings. And then really, as we've talked already a little bit about here, through the environmental quality credits, really focusing on the volatile organic compounds, the off-gassed chemicals of concern that we talked about previously, focusing on those and what we're putting into our buildings, so that we're doing as much as we can to control and reduce exposure of the people in the building to those over time, trying to give as much focus on health and productivity as we can.
We did have another caller who also asked me to relay the question, so hopefully I'm doing it justice. This caller was told by a local fairly large contractor recently that LEED certification is falling off. I think that means falling out of vogue, that less people are trying to attain LEED certification. And so A, is that true? And B, your thoughts on why that would be?
Yeah, so I would say that that's not... that's not untrue. It definitely has reduced. And I would say that when I saw the biggest boom in people talking about LEED was really pre-recession. And then during the recession, I think everybody was just kind of trying to build whatever they could. And what I hear or what I have heard for the last few years from developers and others is the term all but certified, which I find very frustrating because it means that we're building buildings where we're saying it's a green building, but with no measurable proof that anything has been done differently from standard practice. So I have seen in, I would say, the past maybe 12 months, what I feel like is an increase in the number of clients both aware of LEED and now asking again about it. We are in a new version of LEED, LEED version 4.0, which has shifted the overall focus from just being focused really on sort of overall utility efficiency and health to focusing much more in much more depth on the quality and type of materials being used and on the health of the occupants than we've really seen before. It's also a big shift in that we're really moving from credits that are focused on the prescription of what should be done and more focused on the performance, measured performance. So that's my perspective on it anyway. I see an increase of it now, but it has definitely dipped.
You talked about energy efficiency, but then you also said you look at that first and then you look at renewables. And can you tell us a little bit about how that goes together? Because I'm wondering how you can consider the energy efficiency without looking simultaneously at, or even first, at the renewables.
Sure. So, and that's actually pretty common. When you start to talk about green building, the first thing a lot of people think of is that you're going to put a wind turbine on your site or cover your roof in solar panels, which is awesome. That's a fantastic solution. But I really encourage everybody I work with for clients and people I meet to really focus on how much energy you're using first, on getting the amount of energy that you're using down as low as you can through everything from insulating your building and making sure that your windows are airtight, that you've got storms on them or whatnot. Then looking at your air conditioning system, how efficient is it? How efficiently are you heating water in your building? And then once you've got the what, again, we call the footprint of the building, the environmental footprint of your building, as small as it can be, that's when you offset what remains there with solar or wind or other renewables. So because the renewables are the most expensive solution among all of the solutions that are available to us, we want to do the things that are inexpensive first to really reduce the total amount first. I'll just use my own home as an example. I got bids for to do solar about 3 years ago now, and at the time we had something around a 7.8 kW footprint. That's kilowatt hours. So we would need a pretty large array that covered really more than our entire roof. Between now and then, we've gone through an air sealed, insulated, and they size the solar array based on your utility usage. So we went from a 7.8, and then here this fall we had it looked at again, and we were down to a 6. So rather than spending that, however many extra thousands of dollars it would have been to go to a 7.8 system, reducing it as low as it can go through the things that are really within reach for everybody, things that anybody can do on their house.
Now, one thing, we talked about the roofing materials before. And what I'm wondering is, in terms of insulation, of course, the primary purpose of insulation in the roof is to prevent loss of heat. So you're not
heating the outdoors or cooling the outdoors. Yeah, especially.
My question is though, then during the summertime, if you're trapping the heat inside the house,
sure,
isn't that same insulation causing you to use more electricity for the air conditioner because you've trapped the heat and now the AC is working harder?
Well, the idea is to insulate between the outdoors and the living space so that you're creating a buffer between really what is unconditioned space and what and the air that you're trying to keep in the house. I've worked for years on residential houses through some volunteer work. And one of the solutions that we really look at often is ensuring that the houses that we look at, that they have proper ventilation in the roof. And a great strategy for dealing with summer heat that really even bypasses insulation is what's called radiant barrier. And radiant barrier is essentially a laminated piece of foil. There are paint on products that I cannot strongly discourage people enough from using, because that is the wrong solution in our climate. But the laminated foil, the radiant barrier product.
So when you say that, you're like painting your roof white is not a good idea?
Well, you're painting from the bottom. So you're painting the back of the roof. Or that's what I'm saying not to do. Okay. What I'm saying to do is to use a radiant barrier, which is this essentially foil product that goes onto the bottom of the roof rafters. And as long as your roof is properly ventilated, it creates a convection current that passively cools your attic space. Then if you also put down somewhere around about 2 feet is what I would recommend in our climate of some kind of insulation, whether it's cellulose or loose fiberglass, on top of the ceiling in your attic space, then you've created really a zone in there that is not conditioned, but it's also passively getting the heat out of the space during the summer, and in the winter it's keeping the heat in the house.
And so the radiant barrier would go underneath the other insulation.
No, it's not part of the insulation at all. It goes on the bottom of the rafters on the sloped part of your roof.
Okay.
Yeah, right. It just staples right on there, and it works fantastic. Okay. For very, very little money.
And I assume from the other comments you made about the foam insulation that the foam insulation some companies market for the attic, that would be something you would want to avoid?
There are certainly places and times when it makes a lot of sense, and I don't want to discourage it entirely, because there are places where it's still the best solution. Mm-hmm. But just within, I would say, the last 3 or 4 years, the more I've learned about some of the hazards that come with it, the more concerned I am about using a lot of it as a sort of a go-to solution, as the only solution that I look at.
Yeah. And somebody has a house where they have the foam insulation between plywood and their siding and the walls.
Mm-hmm.
Should they be alarmed about it? Or
No. I'm definitely not trying to freak anybody.
Because they put that in on my house.
Yeah, no, that's great. Like what it does, it's really good at in terms of building science. Some of those the foam products are fantastic, in that they deal with both water and air coming in and going from the house, while also providing a very high R value. When it's encapsulated like that, I would be less concerned than if it were exposed anywhere.
Okay.
Within the building.
And then, I'm not real good at pronouncing this word, cellulose?
Cellulose?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Insulation. That's made from paper.
Mm-hmm.
So what did they do to make that fire retardant, and is that safe then?
Yeah, so cellulose is typically treated with a borate product to make it mold and mildew resistant, and then there are some flame retardants in it as well to help deal with that. Not quite the same level that you get with some of the foam plastics, but anyhow, yeah, it's a good product. Personally, on my own home, I ended up using a dense pack fiberglass in my walls and in my attic, just based on everything I've learned over the years about dealing with historic homes and moisture and insulation and right. Energy and all that.
Okay, we are ready to take our second break, and we'll be back in a moment.
The power of water, the good, the bad, and the bubbly on this Current Cast. Rushing, cascading, bubbling. It's that movement of flowing water that creates hydropower. Typically, a dam is built in a river holding back the water to form a reservoir. When released, the force of the water's flow spins the blades of a giant turbine, which in turn activates a generator and produces electricity. Hydropower has been around since the first plant was built in Wisconsin in the late 19th century, and today provides about one-fifth of the world's electricity. The energy it creates is inexpensive, renewable, and clean. But dams can also destroy river habitat and disrupt wildlife and other natural resources. So the design and management are key. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
All right. Thank you for joining us back here on Eco Radio. And we are continuing with my guest, Jeremy Knoll, who is the project manager at BNIM, and we're talking about sustainability in construction. During our break, you mentioned you've got some things you would suggest in terms of sustainability, things that people can do to in their homes. So if you can tell us a little bit, one is some of the stuff that you would recommend in new construction.
Sure.
As well as some of the things that can be done in an old home.
Sure. So I guess I'll start with new construction. And before I go too far into it, I should say that buildings in America account for 72% of our overall electricity use. And of that, more than half of that is in residential. So making small changes in your home or the way we're designing a new home can really make a big swing in terms of our national energy use and footprint. Like a lot of the people listening over the new year here, I was really concerned about frozen pipes in my house and in my parents' house. And so started working out a list of things that really anybody could do to start to deal with energy in their house when the weather is extreme, either extremely cold or extremely hot. So the number one thing that I really recommend this time of year is to replace your furnace filter monthly, both in dealing with the flu season, but also in how often your the blower in your air conditioning system is working. Keeping that clean and clear is really going to be a good way to make sure that your equipment is operating properly. And what I recommend as you look at a new furnace filter is that you look for, there's a little acronym on it that's MERV, and look for a MERV 8 as a minimum filtration, because that'll take care of things like pollen and other allergens that are circulating through your house otherwise. Number two is to insulate the pipes, especially the hot water pipes in your house. You can buy simple foam deals that just pop right on there, and you can use electrical tape or other materials to just seal it up. Some of them are self-adhering. Air sealing the ducts in your basement with mastic is something that anybody driving home could stop and buy a little thing in mastic and some rubber gloves and go do this evening. Not a hard thing to do at all. And can save you up to 30% of your, or it makes at least sure that about 30% of the what is currently air loss into your basement is actually getting where you're trying to send it in your home. Another one, if you've got an old chimney like I do, the flue that's in that is not actually designed to do really anything to air except for provide a general stop for smoke. So you can order what's called a chimney balloon, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a little balloon that you inflate inside your chimney that stops the air that's in your living room or wherever your fireplace is from just going up and out of your house. And really in Kansas City, one of the best things that you can do that can be a do-it-yourself project, but is also something that you can hire pretty easily, is to insulate the board that is at the top of your basement wall. It's called the rim joist. And if you can insulate that and air seal it, that is where most of the energy in our residential homes in Kansas City, it just goes right out that one little board that's between you and the outside. But otherwise, there are also Kansas City Power and Light Inspire programs like their Nest thermostat program. They'll even, if you sign up, there's a home review where somebody comes to your house, asks you about questions about your energy use, and then provides you with things like free LED bulbs, faucet aerators, other things that can immediately make your house more efficient. And then they also have equipment rebates if you're thinking about replacing a furnace. And then if you are able to get an energy audit from a qualified contractor, that's a great way to get a really clear priority list of ways that you can go about improving your own energy footprint over time. If you're doing new construction, some of the things that you can look at will be, we mentioned before some of the red list materials, being sure that what you're designing and what you're building into that space is free from as many of those red list chemicals of concern as you can, that you're using things like we mentioned, like a rock wool insulation instead of a foam plastic insulation if possible, and other measures like that. Make sure that you're, if it if you're looking at a decision between just the standard off-the-shelf air conditioning system and one that's rather than 80% efficient is 95% efficient, and you're going to live in the house for more than 2 or 3 years, then definitely go with the more efficient version of that. Even if you're in your own home and you're thinking about replacing the equipment that you have, that more efficient piece of equipment will pay for itself in very short order through energy efficiency. And a piece of equipment that is more efficient is also, because it's working less hard, should also have a longer life to itself. If it's not chugging away all the time at minimum efficiency, then it should last a few more years than a standard piece of equipment would.
And if you want to put in new insulation in the walls, mm-hmm. into an old home,
sure.
What's the best way to do that? I'm guessing most people aren't going to want to tear out all of their sheetrock and rebuild the entire inside to get to that space.
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, I personally did a dense pack fiberglass, which it's densely packed into the wall, so you get a higher, what's called an R value out of it. And the way that they went about that in my older home, it's a 1922 little house, is that they actually went through, and at the top of each wall, they cored about a 3-inch little hole into the plaster, filled it. They put a hose down into the wall cavity, filled it until it filled to the top, and then they put a little spacer in there and put a piece of and just basically plastered right over the top of it. So they were gone by the time they were done. Now we did have to repaint. So that was kind of a pain, but our energy bill is 30% of what it was last year, so that's okay. A pretty big benefit. No, small price to pay.
When they're injecting that into the wall, though, is there a problem with, in some homes, if there's any cracks in the wall where the injection process would cause pressure on the walls and cause them to buckle more?
That's certainly something to be aware of. I would be much less concerned with that from fiberglass or cellulose than I would with foam, because foam is an expanding, essentially an accelerant, or it's an oil product with an accelerant in it. So once it starts expanding, there's really nowhere for it to go. Whereas the fiberglass and the cellulose products have air in between the pieces of material that are in there, so there's a little bit more give.
Okay. And one of the terms that you used a few times was rock wall.
Rock wool. Yeah, like sheep's wool.
Okay.
But it's essentially like spun heated rock.
So it actually has wool in it?
No.
Okay.
No, it has the consistency of wool, though. It's like a fiberglass without the glass.
Oh, okay. All right. So we're just about out of time. Is there like a closing comment you want to make? We've got about 1 minute.
Sure. I guess just to bring it all together, if you're thinking about efficiency and green building, I really encourage everybody to think first about what are the things that you can do that are passive. What can you improve the insulation in your house? Can you improve the air sealing? And then think about the active systems. How efficient is your air conditioning system? How efficiently are you using water? And then once you've done those things, then start to think about the more active systems like renewable energy, and offset what you've got left, because that can really make for a great building.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for being here. And for those just joining us, this will be available on podcast later. And we will include, if you can give us some websites after the show, for people that might want to look at some additional information about this.
Sure.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
How polluted is the Kansas River? January 17th from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. Join concerned citizens and environmental experts at the Kansas River. How polluted is it and how much better can we make it? Forum. Tom Stiles, Assistant Director of the KDHE, is the featured speaker. This free Earth Care Forum will be held from 7 to 8 p.m. on Wednesday, January 17th at Central United Methodist Church Fellowship Hall, which is located at 1501 Massachusetts Street in Lawrence, Kansas. There will be an additional discussion of topics surrounding the various water advocacy team focus groups from 8 to 9 p.m. The forum is sponsored by the Lawrence Ecological Teams United for Sustainability. Swap seeds at Seed Savers Exchange, January 20th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Start planting your garden now at the annual Seed Savers Kansas City Seed Exchange and share seeds, bulbs, and tubers with other gardeners. Take seeds in individually labeled envelopes to trade from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday, January 20th at the Anita B. Gorman Conservation Discovery Center, 4750 Troost Avenue. Seed Savers Exchange encourages the use of heirloom non-GMO seeds. For more information, go to www.seedsavers-kc.org.
A chemical used in weapons is showing up in water samples. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The tragic mudslides in Southern California last week have killed 18, with 5 people still missing. More than 60 homes were destroyed and more than 400 damaged.
According to the National Weather Service, over 6 inches of rain fell near Montecito, where the disaster struck.
Mudslides like the one that occurred last week are not new. A fact sheet by the USGS says that flooding and debris flows are common in the aftermath of wildfires such as the Thomas Fire that recently devastated the area and was only contained last week after burning for a month.
KPCC reports there's been a long history of mudslides in Southern California, with one of the worst occurring in 1969 that killed 87.
The recent wildfires and mudslides were on the minds of 2 members of the Los Angeles City Council who last week urged the city to file suit against oil companies for damages they see as linked to climate change.
Their call follows a lawsuit filed last week by New York City against 5 major oil companies. The city claims the companies have known for years that burning fossil fuels causes global warming, but hid that knowledge, and that together the 5 companies produced 11% of all global warming gases through the products they sold.
The suit seeks to shift the costs of protecting the city onto the companies that have created the conditions leading to climate change.
In response to New York's action, a spokesman for Chevron told the Washington Post that the suit will do nothing to address the serious issue of climate change. And a spokesperson for ExxonMobil added that the lawsuits filed by trial attorneys do not reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
New York City is also planning to divest its pension funds from fossil fuels. About $5 billion will be invested in other industries as long as pension fund trustees agree.
A chemical which is used to make military explosives is showing up in water and soil samples.
According to recent reporting by ProPublica, the substance known as RDX that was developed by the U.S. during the Second World War and is still used today is being carried by winds during weapons testing and settling in soils.
From there, it easily moves into water supplies. Surface and groundwater samples show that RDX persists and does not quickly dissolve or break down.
Recently, Canadian researchers looked at soil and water samples and found that in nearly 75% of them, RDX made its way into aquifers, exceeding safe levels.
RDX has been classified as a possible carcinogen by the EPA. The agency suggested that it has a danger score stricter than other deadly pollutants such as benzene and atrazine.
The RDX contamination is not confined to the U.S. and is, according to the researchers, an internationally known issue. ProPublica states that one of the EPA's foremost experts on pollution from explosives has said that RDX is the single greatest problem the U.S. faces when it comes to cleaning up thousands of toxic munitions sites.
But the Pentagon says that RDX does not pose a great risk and has fought against the EPA classifying it as a likely carcinogen.
Large quantities of water ice have been discovered on Mars by a powerful camera on board NASA's reconnaissance orbiter.
The ice formations were seen in areas where erosion has removed rocks and surface dirt, exposing steep cross-sections of frozen water that range from 1 to 100 meters in depth.
The journal Wired reports that it's not just the volume of water found, it's how mineable it promises to be to support things like drinking, growing crops, or making hydrogen for fuel.
The water ice was found further north than where the current Mars landing missions can go because of extremely low temperatures. Scientists theorize that one might have to drill deeper in areas closer to the Martian equator to find the ice.
Two missions to the Red Planet are planned in 2020, one by NASA and the other by the European Space Agency, both of which will be capable of studying the ice in more detail. The discovery was reported in last week's issue of Science by researchers led by the USGS.
And finally, last week, British Prime Minister Theresa May unveiled a new green agenda for the UK in which she pledged to eliminate the scourge of plastics. Speaking at a nature reserve just south of London, she outlined a plan to eradicate avoidable plastic waste within 25 years.
That plan includes things like calling on supermarkets to create plastic-free aisles when displaying food and imposing a levy on all single-use plastics from coffee cups to spoons and forks. She also wants to extend a charge on plastic bags to all retailers, including corner shops, in an effort to take millions of sacks out of circulation.
While environmental groups applauded her efforts for raising awareness about plastics and other issues, they complained that the plan lacked specifics and didn't go far enough. Opposition politicians said the announcement was just a cynical ploy to attract young eco-conscious voters to her Conservative Party. Recent polling found that climate change was the top policy issue for Britons aged 18 to 28.
But there might be another reason for the sudden interest in going green: China. Last year, the country announced it would no longer be the world's garbage dump, recycling about half of the globe's plastics and paper. A ban on that recycling went into effect on January 1st.
According to Greenpeace, every year, Britain sent enough recyclables to China to fill 10,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. The United States ships so many millions of tons of scrap paper and plastic annually to China, it's the sixth largest export to the country.
While China's move has left Western countries scrambling to deal with their waste, most environmental groups say the answer is clear: find sustainable alternatives to plastics.
To that end, they might take a lead from the Lonely Whale Foundation, which began its Strawless in Seattle campaign last September. The group seeks to raise awareness about plastic pollution in the oceans and the impact our lifestyles have on the environment, such as using plastic straws.
In other words, protect the planet and don't suck.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, bringing together the best and brightest minds in the water sector at ACE 18. Learn more at awwa.org/ACE18.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.